Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mars, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 7th of January, these are our main stories. The frontrunner to become the next Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, says he now has enough support to win despite losing 13 votes in the last 4 days. A senior official in eastern Ukraine says Russia has never stopped carrying out attacks, in spite of a unilateral ceasefire declared by President Putin. The president of Mexico has defended the operation that captured a drug cartel leader, Ovidio Guzman, which resulted in lethal violence. Also in this podcast...
I'm a serious searcher. I've been searching in this area for 30 years, and I found nice objects, especially Roman ones.
Now he and many others are on the hunt for Nazi treasure. Nothing in politics is straightforward, but attempts in the US to elect a new Speaker of the US House of Representatives have become frustrating and almost farcical, as this montage illustrates.
No persons, having received a majority of the whole number of votes cast by surname, a Speaker has not been elected. A Speaker has not been elected. A Speaker
and
has
so
not
been
elected.
And so it went on. There were 13 votes that have been going on for a grueling 4 days now. Well, the Republican Kevin McCarthy is the front runner, as he said, but so far he's failed those 13 times to secure a majority. But he remains very confident. It now seems the number of those voting against him appears to be dwindling. Just before recording this podcast, Julian Marshall spoke to the BBC's Anthony Zerker in Washington and asked him if we were moving on to a 14th vote.
Well, not quite yet. Right now we're moving on to a break. They're voting to adjourn until about 10 o'clock in the evening here in Washington, D.C. time. And that is because of the 20 votes that were against Kevin McCarthy or for someone other than Kevin McCarthy at the beginning of the day. That's dropped down to 6. And they need it to get down to 3 or 4 by 10 o'clock tonight, when a couple of other Republicans could come in and help add up the vote count for Kevin McCarthy.
And what accounts for those who have opposed him dropping their opposition?
Well, there had been talk for the past couple of days about a deal that Kevin McCarthy could offer them, changing the rules of the way the House of Representatives runs to make it easier, say, to amend legislation on the floor, to give the hardcore conservative members of the House of Representatives greater representation within key congressional committees that control the House of Representatives, to allow it to make it easier for even just one member of Congress to trigger a vote to see whether to remove the Speaker of the House of Representatives, something that they view as being able to hold Kevin McCarthy more accountable going forward. This package apparently has been offered and agreed on, and that won over a sizable chunk of those holdouts.
But there are those, I understand, who just cannot stand Kevin McCarthy as a person.
There do seem to be a few who their opposition is more than just professional, it's personal. People like Matt Gaetz, congressman from Florida, and Lauren Boebert, a congresswoman from Colorado, they have been adamant that they will not stop opposing Kevin McCarthy until he steps aside and someone else runs. And the thing is, because the Republican majority in this House of Representatives is so narrow, it only takes a handful of holdouts for whatever reason to block him from becoming Speaker of the House. And while those larger opposition has been whittled down to just a few, it only will take a few, 3 or 4, to block him.
What does this tell us, though, about the rest of this Congress's life, if there can be this kind of division within the Republican Party at this stage? It doesn't augur well for party unity in the future, does it?
No, it tells us it's going to be a long few years for Republicans in the House of Representatives. This was supposed to be one of the easier things to do. Electing a Speaker of the House when you have a majority in the House is supposed to be something that's pretty easy for your party. Obviously, we haven't seen anything like this for about 100 years, haven't seen a Speaker nomination fight like this go this long since before the Civil War. So that tells you alone enough about the uniqueness of this and the difficulty that Kevin McCarthy has been facing.
That was Anthony Zerker in Washington. Meanwhile, President Biden has praised the people who protected the US Capitol against rioters who attempted to overturn the result of the last presidential election. In a ceremony marking the second anniversary of the deadly attack on the 6th of January 2021, Mr. Biden said history would remember those who protected American democracy.
On this day, 2 years ago, our democracy held because we, the people, did not flinch. We, the people, endured. We, the people, prevailed. On this day of remembrance, we honor a remarkable group of Americans who embodied the best before, during, and after January the 6th, 2021.
President Biden. Next to Ukraine, it was only meant to be a temporary ceasefire. And in the end, it wasn't even that, really. Ukraine had dismissed President Putin's offer of a Orthodox Christian truce as just propaganda. And when it was due to come into effect on Friday at midday local time, the guns remained pretty much active all across Ukraine. A regional governor in the east of the country said Russia had not stopped carrying out attacks and had only paused to bring in more shells. This Ukrainian commander near the city of Kremina in Luhansk Oblast gave his reaction as explosions were heard in the distance.
We have already learned not to trust them. They are treacherous enemies. We do not trust them. What ceasefire? Can you hear that? What do they want to achieve if they keep shooting? We know. We have learned not to trust them.
I asked our correspondent in the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, James Waterhouse, if there had been a lull in the fighting there.
A place like Kramatorsk has been attacked on an almost daily basis with shelling and missile strikes. There's an industrial estate a couple of kilometres from where we are, which is regularly targeted. Since our arrival this afternoon, it has been relatively quiet. We arrived to sirens, a possible symptom of the ceasefire not quite working as it should, but there are reports further away in the city of Bakhmut, where we continue to see the heaviest fighting. There are reports today of exchanges of artillery fire throughout the afternoon. And I think we're seeing the inevitable accusation and counter-accusation between local Ukrainian officials and Moscow-installed politicians in occupied areas, where they accuse each other of breaking the ceasefire and targeting sites. It's worth reiterating, though, that Ukraine was never going to engage in this.
You're in a part of the country where there's a huge front line, hundreds of kilometres long. President Zelensky was very clear in his New Year message that the goal for 2023 was to liberate every single square kilometre of land occupied by Russia. What are you hearing about any kind of movement, or is it a real sense of stalemate along that front line?
Well, first off, whenever Ukraine, if we look at September, when Ukraine has enjoyed success in terms of counteroffensives and retaken huge amounts of territory, like we saw in the northeastern Kharkiv region, we didn't know anything about it. Us journalists were kind of phased out in that sense. They really did keep it under the radar. We knew about the Kherson offensive. That was a lot more attritional, and ultimately Russia did withdraw. At the moment, from our relatively limited perspective, it's not clear that any kind of major offensive is afoot. You often see a lot, you know, fuel tanks and armoured vehicles making their way to the front line. There's always activity behind the front line, but we've got to remember that this is a part of Ukraine which is no stranger to war. This is a part of Ukraine where there's been fighting for 9 years, where before the invasion, Ukraine's army was fighting Russian-backed separatist militants. People here, I don't think, are going to be expecting a sudden breakthrough. The support from the West seems to be becoming more and more significant. Ukraine hasn't stopped asking, but a lot needs to happen, I think, before we see Ukraine fully retake the regions of Luhansk and Donetsk, parts of which have long been under Russian control. I think a lot still needs to happen.
James Waterhouse in Kramatorsk. Next to Mexico, and the president has been defending a military operation that captured a drug cartel leader, triggering unrest in his home state of Sinaloa. Ovidio Guzman was captured in the state capital, Culiacan, and flown to Mexico City. His arrest led to widespread attacks by members of the Sinaloa cartel in Culiacan. On Thursday, 19 members of the cartel and 10 soldiers were reportedly killed in the course of the violence. So why did the president sign off on this operation when such consequences were likely? Julian Marshall spoke to Ion Grillo, a journalist in Mexico City.
It's still a bit ambiguous about whether he signed off on an operation to get him, whether the military did it without a president saying he did, or even whether they kind of ran into him by accident. It's still not completely clear. But the president, López Obrador, has certainly taken ownership of this. And I think this changes the dynamics and slays the demons of what happened in 2019 when the military captured Ovidio Guzman and then released him under violent pressure from the cartels. And that really made President López Obrador look weak and corrupt and was kind of used many times kind of to cite to make him look bad. And this capture, despite the violence, really, you know, makes him kind of reclaim a bit that territory and makes him look tougher. The idea of hugs, not bullets, which was a kind of phrase that President López Obrador had during the campaign and first kind of tried to enact, really has died. And you can kind of see from the rhetoric this morning by the military general, by the head of public security, and by the president himself, it's very different than it was 3 years ago. It's now like saying we've got to be tough on these people who are hurting civilians and we can't give in to them.
So the capture of Ovidio Guzman, however it came about, is highly significant.
Yeah, it's a very big political capture. In terms of drug trafficking, it doesn't make a huge difference. Ovidio Guzman is one of four of Chapo's sons in this faction of the Sinaloa cartel called Los Chapitos. They're only one faction of the Sinaloa cartel, and the Sinaloa cartel is only one of many cartels. However, politically, it's a very important arrest. I think the significance of allowing Ovidio Guzman to go before was huge. It was this idea that cartels, that gangsters can do what they like, that the government is working with them or is just simply complicit and allowing them to do what they like. And in terms of kind of a psychological blow against them, a symbolic blow against impunity, is very important.
I am Grillo in Mexico City. Police in Kenya say they've arrested a suspect following the killing of an LGBTQ rights campaigner and fashion designer. Edwin Chiloba's body showed signs of torture. It was found by the roadside near the western town of Eldoret on Wednesday. The police say the suspect is believed to be a longtime friend of the victim. Rights organisations in Kenya, where gay sex is outlawed, are linking the killing to his sexuality. The BBC's Africa correspondent Anne Soy has more details about Edwin Chiloba.
He was a 26-year-old fashion designer, upcoming. He was just completing his degree in fashion and design in the western town of Eldoret. He was in his final year, but he was already making waves across the industry and within the LGBT community, dressing in very colourful outfits. And he was quite a well-known figure within those circles. And there's a video that has been circulating showing him dancing with his friends on the 31st of December, looking very jolly, and that was the last time that he was seen alive. The latest development now is that we understand there's a suspect in custody. A man who's been described as his best friend with whom he was living has been arrested by police. We understand that neighbours reported hearing some commotion from their apartment before he disappeared. He was later found dumped inside a metal box along a remote road in the outskirts of Eldoret, where he lived.
That was Anne Soy. Israel has announced retaliatory measures following last week's Palestinian appeal for the International Court of Justice to look into Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Benjamin Netanyahu's new right-wing government says it's to stop some Palestinian construction and use Palestinian funds to compensate Israeli victims of terrorism. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
Mr. Netanyahu's office said the measures were in response to the Palestinian Authority's decision to wage what it described as political and legal war against the State of Israel. Last week, the UN General Assembly agreed, after a Palestinian appeal, to seek the view of the International Court of Justice on Israel's 55-year occupation of Palestinian territories. The court's rulings are binding, though it has no power to enforce them.
Mike Thompson. Next to the Philippines. Now, it is said to be one of a number of countries most vulnerable to climate change. And it's also one of the most dangerous places in the world to try to defend the environment. The Sierra Madre mountain range, which forms the backbone of the nation's biggest island, Luzon, was originally covered in rainforest, which did much to absorb the heavy rains from typhoons, which form in the Pacific. Our correspondent Laura Bicker has trekked into the mountains to speak to those who want to protect the forest and to meet illegal loggers who want to exploit it.
This is a sound forest rangers across the Philippines have come to dread. Chainsaws are registered here, just like guns. Mark bought his after selling a cow 7 years ago. He's made money using it to illegally cut down trees. He and his wife Grace hide deep in the Sierra Madre mountain range, selling wood for houses and construction projects. Mark knows it's dangerous, but he says they'll catch him when he's dead.
My message for people is not to get angry at us because we do not actually want this. We can only get our money for basic necessities from here. They can afford to be mad because they have other sources of livelihood. But for us, we have none.
They chop and dry the wood and transport it in the dark via the river. A big order can take up to a month, but will earn them $300.
They said illegal logging is destroying nature. God gave all this to us, so we can use it.
Others have turned their back on illegal logging. Forest ranger Francisco leads us and his volunteers through dense woodland to check on his latest tree planting site.
It's pretty squelchy underfoot.
The trail is thick with mud. You have to duck under branches, climb over roots. And I note that many of the volunteers are in flip-flops. Francisco once made a living chopping down these trees until a deadly landslide killed thousands.
Did you feel an element of guilt? Is that why you became a forest ranger?
He turns his back to me in tears when I ask him about it.
Yes, I had trauma back then because I saw lifeless children all lined up on the streets while the houses were all destroyed. There weren't any houses left. Even ours was gone. When I remember the things we did, I feel helpless.
Francisco and many others believe the Sierra Madre saves lives, that she's the backbone of the Philippines. Her peaks shield against strong typhoon winds and her thick forests absorb heavy rains. Keeping her safe, he said, is now more important than ever, as this country is one of the most vulnerable in the world to the effects of climate change. But his job comes with risks. 270 people have been killed in the last 10 years defending Filipino rainforests. Francisco works for the Haribon Foundation and is keen to avoid any confrontation.
Once we called out someone to stop cutting trees, they told us that they might kill us. I told them that we weren't there to pick a fight and were just explaining what will happen to all of us if they continue what they do. You won't be the only one affected. It's all of us.
Mining, quarrying, illegal logging have stripped away 90% of the original rainforest here. People in this developing country want and need jobs, roads, houses. The real challenge is finding a balance and persuading people that growing new life in these forests now may protect human lives in the future.
That report by Laura Bicker in the Philippines. Still to come.
Dr. Clement Defoe wants to be seeing patients. Instead, he is feeding his chickens.
Many of them died recently. I'm much better with humans.
We find out why there are so many out-of-work doctors in Cameroon. In Britain, former members of the armed forces have criticised Prince Harry regarding his claim in his autobiography that he killed 25 Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. Other soldiers have said that the prince's confession is a security risk that will, in their words, feed jihadist propaganda. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
Prince Harry says he flew six missions in Helmand when his Apache helicopter engaged the enemy with a result of loss of life. He claims to have killed 25 Taliban fighters, and making that number public has surprised many in the military. One serving soldier who did several tours of Afghanistan told the BBC it was unusual and unsoldier-like to keep such a tally. He said it was not always easy to work out what happened in the fog of war and heat and dust of Helmand. In a helicopter, Prince Harry would have had a better view than most of the battle beneath him. He could have reviewed cockpit video to try to verify his count. But battle damage assessments are just that, estimates. The Iraq war veteran, Colonel Tim Collins, has called the prince's disclosure a tragic money-making scam. He said counting the enemy killed was not how most behaved or even thought in the army. Even friends have expressed their displeasure. Sean McBean, a seriously injured Royal Marine who flew back from Afghanistan with Harry, said his claim would not help comrades back home, concerned about their own safety.
It hasn't done him any favours with security, and living in America with all of his bodyguards and a big mansion with gates around it, if they can't get access to Harry, they might think, right, let's try and target someone here in the UK, his regiment or whatever, their barracks. They don't live in big mansions with security, so there's no positive that's come out of him saying that.
The Taliban, too, have condemned the prince for likening the taking of human life to removing pieces from a chessboard. But the criticism is not just about the sensitivities around killing. It's about the wisdom of putting numbers and details in a book, especially when some might still be seeking revenge. The Ministry of Defence said it would not comment on operational details for security reasons.
That was Jonathan Beale. Thousands of people held a protest on Friday in Pakistan's northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province against escalating violence across the region. Ambrasan Etarajan reports.
Holding white flags and placards, the demonstrators in Wana town in Pakistan's South Waziristan region chanted slogans in support of peace. People from all walks of life, including social activists, traders and students, took part in the rally. Residents are worried about the return of the fighters from the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or the TTP. The Islamist militants once dominated large swathes of the mountainous region bordering Afghanistan. The Pakistani government has warned that it will adopt a zero-tolerance policy towards terrorism.
That was Ambrasan Etarajan. India has banned tourism activities like consuming alcohol and non-vegetarian food at the Samad Shikharji pilgrimage site in Jharkhand state. The site is holy for the Jain community. Ria Khattab reports.
India's Jain community is a religious minority comprising around 4.5 million believers. Under the spiritual guidance of monks, devout Jains follow principles that include detailed prescriptions for daily life, especially what to eat, what not to eat, and when to eat. For weeks, members have been protesting against the government decision to turn the Samad Shikharji pilgrimage site into a tourist spot. The government has now responded, saying it recognises the sanctity of the area and is therefore banning activities including unauthorised camping, playing loud music, and damaging flora or fauna.
Arya Khattab. Next to Cameroon in West Africa, where the number of out-of-work doctors in the country has soared since a change in government policy drastically cut the number of jobs offered to new graduates in the public health system. Since the move was implemented in 2020, new doctors say they're having to find alternative ways to make a living, sometimes practicing medicine illegally. Nick Loomis reports from Douala.
Dr. Clement Defoe wants to be seeing patients. Instead, he is feeding his chickens.
Many of them died recently. I'm much better with humans.
He is one of Cameroon's thousands of unemployed doctors, and like many, he has looked beyond medicine to earn a living. As well as raising chickens, he also has a brick-making business and a shop in a busy market in Douala.
I always have this feeling that this is not my place. No doctor should have to run a shop. But at the same time, I have to make a living.
Doctors graduating from public universities were always guaranteed a job in the state health system until that government policy came to an end.
I think it was our last year of medical school that things changed. We even told ourselves that it was a joke, false rumors.
But some graduates are refusing to give up on their hard-earned skills, even if they have to use them outside the law. It's 8:30 at night in a remote suburb of Douala, and one such doctor, who wishes to remain anonymous, is carefully making his way in the dark to an elderly patient's home. He examines her under dim lighting and lines up three chairs for her to lie across. He knows seeing patients without a private practice license is illegal, but he feels he has no choice. The examination over, he writes a prescription and is handed a banknote worth about $8.
Running around all day like this and a doctor only earns 5,000 francs.
He explains that by the time he gets home, he will have spent five of those $8 on transport. The day before this house call, I met him outside the medical school where he studied for 7 years.
The dream that we had when we started studying was stolen from us by the state. And now we only have disappointment and sadness.
The Doctors' Union of Cameroon estimates that at least 2,000 general practitioners have graduated in the past 3 years, and that the vast majority of them are unemployed. This year, as in the past 2 years, only 50 will be brought into the public health system by selection.
If a doctor is unemployed, he will struggle a bit. But it's the Cameroonian people who will really suffer from a lack of quality medical care.
There is roughly one doctor for every 7,000 inhabitants in Cameroon, according to the government. But most are concentrated in city centers, leaving many health care voids throughout the country. The Minister of Public Health, Malachi Manaouda, agrees that there is a problem, but suggests the solution may lie outside the government.
Now, is the public health system the only way forward? I don't think so. There is also the private sector, but the private sector practice is not one's living room or bedroom. It's the creation of a private institution.
Having fed his chickens, Dr. Defoe is off to the market to buy a product a customer has ordered online from his shop. He says he is working to raise the funds to set up a private clinic, but that the costs are considerable and the application he's filed may take years.
Nick Loomis in Cameroon. An old map believed to mark the spot where German soldiers hid treasure worth millions of dollars during the Second World War has gone on public view for the first time in the Netherlands. And not surprisingly, it has created a bit of a frenzy of excitement amongst amateur treasure hunters there. Groups have been wandering through the fields where they believe the treasure was buried, searching, digging and sifting through the mud. Andrew Ochieng has more.
That's Jan Hansen with his metal detector in a bushy area in the village of Ommeren in the Netherlands. He is one of several amateur treasure hunters who have been out looking for four large boxes thought to be full of diamonds, golds and all sorts of jewellery. The treasure is believed to have been looted by Nazi soldiers after an explosion at a bank in August 1944. The current craze started after a map allegedly showing where the treasure was buried was made public this week by the Dutch National Archive. Jan says he was excited by the news of this treasure.
I'm a serious searcher. I've been searching in this area for 30 years, and I found nice objects, especially Roman ones. But now, suddenly, we're told something we haven't known for all these years, that there's probably Nazi treasure buried here. I thought about it overnight, and I decided that I would look for it too.
So there's obviously nothing here, he says. But here there's something. Can you hear it? He adds, beaming. As the spades come out and he starts digging, he realizes he may have been a bit too late. There are already several holes around, he says. Someone else got here before him. Although the existence of the treasure could never be fully confirmed, the Dutch Institute tried to find it several times in 1947 but failed. Some people in the area hope the latest hunt doesn't get out of hand.
Andrew Ochieng reporting. And that's all from us for now, but before we go, have a listen to this. Ah, very relaxing. Those were frogs at night in an eco lodge in Mindo, Ecuador, sent to us by our listener Lily Jenkins from Edinburgh in Scotland. She was on holiday in Ecuador over Christmas, and she says that during the night, when she couldn't sleep, she played the Global News podcast to hear familiar voices. Thank you very much to Lily for that. Now, if you want to get in contact with us, the email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
At Capital One, technology makes direct deposits available up to 2 days sooner, improves fraud defense with machine learning, and helps businesses manage data challenges in the cloud with Slingshot, the first solution from Capital One Software. Search technology at Capital One to learn more.